Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 11th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And this is the February 2015 update or installment of this series. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome back two experts to give the update. The first is Wayne A. Abernathy, who is the Executive VP for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs at the American Bankers Association, and he's also chairman of the Federal Society's Financial Services Practice Group. And then the second expert is Professor Todd J. Zwicky, who is the Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. So we're going to start off, I think, with Todd Zwicky, who's going to begin the presentation, and then we'll hear from Wayne. So, Professor Zwicky, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian, and thank you to everybody for calling in and for our monthly call. And, in fact, it has turned into a monthly call, and thanks to all of you. This started off as a very irregular, as developments warranted sort of thing, but we've been, the CFPB's been and continues to be pretty busy, and there seems to be pretty consistent interest of those of you for this call, and so we've turned it into a monthly update. And just to give you a sense, from now on, we're going to try to, if at all possible, this is going to be the slot that we've sort of picked for these teleform, which is every month, the second Wednesday of the month, beginning at 1 o'clock, unless other circumstances arise. We're going to try to do this on a monthly basis at this time on the second Wednesday of each month. And so hopefully that'll make it more predictable for people. For those who are interested in joining us, you'll be able to know when to expect it. So thank you for your interest in this. And it's been a pleasure for us to talk with you. And we'll continue doing this for the foreseeable future. For those of you who have been on calls in the past, you'll know one of the we'll give you an update on something that's been a fairly constant source of amusement for us bureau watchers, which is the ever escalating price tag of the CFPB, the renovations to the CFPB's headquarters, which of course we're in the Office of Thrift Supervision building right by the White House. The latest, there was a hearing towards the end of January for the House Financial Services Committee. For those keeping a score at home, the current estimate to renovate the building is now $215.8 million after starting off at $95 million. And for those who are interested, the current plans include a green roof, a four-story glass staircase, and something that that is described as a water wall of naturally split granite, which cascades down to a sunken garden terminating into a raised splash pool. So if you want to know where the $215 million is going, obviously they've cut renovation costs to the bone. But this is an issue that continues to just be an interesting source of amazement, really, as the price tag for the renovation to these opulent headquarters continues to increase. The continuation of an update on another story that has somewhat more of a pleasing result is, as you know, we have followed closely the Operation Choke Point operation that the FDIC in particular has been spearheading in connection with the DOJ and others. And at the very end of January, January 28th, the FDIC seems to have substantially retreated on Operation Choke Point, which, as you may recall, last summer the FDIC withdrew their list of suspect industries. Yet that seemed to have little impact on how Operation Choke Point was being executed by banks, who seem to still be continuing to exclude certain industries, notably payday lenders, gun dealers, and some others, from getting banking services. And at one point, there was a firearms dealer who actually went into a bank and recorded his conversations with the bank teller or the loan officer, explaining why that they were terminating their bank account because they didn't like the industry that he was dealing with. And it's unclear whether that was directly tied to Operation Choke Point. But the observation is that most banks had been steering away categorically from certain industries, even after the FDIC had withdrawn its hit list. Finally, at the end of January, the FDIC issued a one-page financial institutions letter, and it specifically instructed institutions to, quote, take a risk-based approach in assessing individual customer relationships, rather than declining to provide banking services to entire categories of customers without regard to the risks presented by an individual customer or the bank's ability to manage the risk. And so what they've instructed them to do is to make it clear that what should have been obvious, which is that banks should make assessments of their customer risk on a case-by-case basis rather than categorically. This also suggests that the FDIC, which had kind of used this 2x4 of reputation risk, of basically saying that banking certain industries posed a reputation risk to the bank, they seem to have retreated somewhat from that very vague and expansive concept of the reputation risk. So this is, I think, we'll see if it actually has bite on the ground with the banks and whether bank examiners actually follow through on this. But the FDIC seemed to have acknowledged the disruption that was being caused by Operation Choke Point, and at least in word, and we'll see if whether indeed they have withdrawn the basic missive of Operation Choke Point, which was to simply not provide banking services to certain industries. And I think one thing we should note on this is that my impression is that the aggressive oversight in Congress of this operation, and the a willingness of Congressman Hensarling and the House Financial Services Chairman McHenry of Government Oversight, I think they're active, engaged. Oh, and Congressman Issa, of course, Issa as well. I think that their involvement in active and engaged supervision of this Operation Choke Point process and their doggedness in getting to the bottom of it, I think, is proven, at least in this case, that informed and aggressive oversight can actually help to bring about some policy accountability from some of these agencies. I'll now turn it over to Wayne to talk about some things involving the complaint databases at the CFPB. Wayne?
Great. Thank you very much, Todd, and I appreciate everybody being on the call. In this call, we're just hitting some of the highlights, so if there are issues that we don't touch on that you would like to have us address, we will certainly be opportunity in the Q&A period, or if you'd like us to expand on some of the issues that we just touched upon, we're certainly happy to do that. Some of you may be aware that the Bureau has had for a number of months the practice of posting on its website complaints that find their way to the Consumer Bureau. And the Consumer Bureau most recently, late last year, announced the intention to not only publish the data on these complaints, but also to begin publishing narratives that complainers provide to the Bureau. These would be unedited. These would just be, and they'd be unedited, unverified, raw information, with the exception of some editing to try to protect the identity of the complainant. But these would be published on the Bureau's website. On January 12th, the letter was, now this is an interesting point, I need to take one step back. The Consumer Bureau, by intention, has very little oversight or accountability. There is, for example, no inspector general that is housed within the Bureau itself. But on January 12th, the letter was sent to the Federal Reserve's inspector general, since technically the Bureau is a bureau of the Federal Reserve, even though the Federal Reserve has by law, no opportunity to weigh in on the budget policies or any of the other operations of the Consumer Bureau. But it does seem to be that the Inspector General of the Federal Reserve does have within his ambit the opportunity to look at operations of the Bureau. So a letter was sent on January 12th requesting that the Federal Reserve Board's Inspector General audit how the Bureau manages those databases and with specific issues pointed to. First, looking at to what extent are these complaints that are being published genuine violations of law or allegations of violation of law, or just complaints reflecting frustration or lack of information or other sorts of things that don't rise to being a violation of law or regulation. Second, the request asks the IG to consider, does the Bureau have in place any kind of system for evaluating the accuracy of the data before they publish the data on their website? And that's important because the website that publishes the information says, and it's the only website that I'm aware of in the federal government that says this, that this is an official agency of the federal government. So there's a federal government imprimatur on this publishing. So that's another question of whether the complaint data is subject to effective controls for accuracy. And then a third question is how effective the Bureau's practices for scrubbing personal information actually are. Or is it possible from the information that would be published to identify the persons involved and some of the personal information? Of course, that is a process that is going forward, but the letter hopefully raises a number of these issues to the attention of the IG that is looking to see to what extent, not the policies, the IG can't look at the policies, but they can look at the practices and some of the legal issues. So we're hopeful that we might get some good response from that. And let me now pass the mic back to Todd Zawicki. He's going to talk about the Military Lending Act, which you might think, well, what does that have to do with the Bureau? Isn't that Department of Defense? The Bureau's all behind it. Go ahead, Todd.
Thanks, Wayne. And this actually, the latest developments on the Military Lending Act actually came out at the very end of December, but didn't make it into the January call, so I figured I would update everybody on this. As you recall, in one of our fall calls, we talked about the amendments to the Military Lending Act, which at the time I referred to jokingly as the Overdraft Protection Stimulus Act of 2014, because it proposes, the Military Lending Act proposes to take the basic idea of the Military Lending Act, which had imposed a 36% APR on certain categories of products that were when the borrower was a military active member of the military, such as payday loans and the like, and now they've basically decided to extend that very broadly to almost every consumer credit product, except by basically for overdraft protection. But in particular, it brings in things like traditional old-fashioned unsecured installment loans, which had not been included in the original Military Lending Act reach. And the comment period closed on December 26th, and I thought particular interest were comments filed by the CFPB and the FTC endorsing the provisions of the Military Lending Act expansion. At the same time, the CFPB published a study called The Extension of High-Cost Credit to Service Members and Their Families, which they gave as the justification for extending the Military Lending Act. And basically, their story is historically a common one, which is that the fact that the original Military Lending Act only imposed usury ceilings on certain products provide an incentive for borrowers and lenders to basically redesign products to evade the terms of the Military Lending Act. So basically to convert payday loans into longer period loans and that sort of thing. Or as the CFPB notes in their study, essentially proving that water runs downhill, the CFPB shows that the use of deposit advance products by banks was much higher for military members. Now, what's odd about this, for one who knows anything about the history of usury regulations, is this is entirely predictable, and this is what has always happened when there are usury regulations. And this is precisely why, after 2,000 years of failed experiments in usury regulations, we finally started getting rid of these in the 1970s and the 1980s, which is that where there is demand for a product, and it is something as fungible and as fluid as money, people can always redesign the products to evade the particular limits on the laws. Now, what the Department of Defense seems to believe, what the CFPB seems to believe, and what the Federal Trade Commission seems to believe in writing in support of the rule is that somehow or another this time it is going to be different, that we can continue to chase our tail and chase faster and faster and faster to try to suppress all the different ways in which these terms and conditions can pop up. But as I said, one of the most obvious things that's excluded from this seems to be overdraft protection, for instance. We know that overdraft protection and payday lendings are substitutes for each other. Of course, the end result is even uglier, which is that where usury regulations have actually operated, it basically has just pushed lending into the black market, or it is provided ways for, say, for businesses to cater to military lenders by basically selling them goods where the prices are marked up to cover the cost of the loans and that sort of thing. Every economist has always believed that usury regulations end up distorting markets, and that's basically why this experiment has been thrown out in the past. I commend to you the dissenting letter from FTC Commissioner Josh Wright, who goes through a lot of this history and talks about the inevitable results of this and why these usury regulations won't work better than anybody else's. Now, the main reason I talk about it is not just because of the distorting effect this will have for military, but a lot of activists, including the New York Times editorial page, have pointed to the Military Lending Act as a model for the return of national usury ceilings on consumer credit products. And a lot of people have interpreted this law as being a success, and they seem to believe that this chasing your tail sort of process is viable. It wouldn't surprise me, given how much ground level support there is for using the MLA as a model for national usury ceilings, if you start over the next, say, 6 months or so, start hearing more and more talk about that sort of thing happening. And so I thought it was worth flagging this and flagging it in the context of the failure to learn from the mistakes of history that usury laws simply cannot keep up with. As long as there is a consumer demand there, there will be some supply that exists to meet it. Wayne?
Great. Thank you very much, Todd. The next issue I'd like us to turn to is a problem that the Bureau has discovered. And apparently this problem is that colleges and universities, at least their administrators, are incapable of negotiating with banks effectively when it comes to establishing joint account programs between the college and the local bank. And therefore, the Bureau, on January 14, stepped in to help the colleges and universities and their administrators all across the land, providing a questionnaire that the colleges and universities should use in any of their negotiations with banks in establishing these joint accounts that they provide to their students. And the Bureau makes clear that in their words, responsible institutions of higher education will, of course, make use of this questionnaire that the Bureau has provided to them. And the questionnaire basically establishes a plain vanilla account that they think is really good for college students, and they encourage universities in the negotiations to say with the bank, why don't you just do this? If in setting up our joint account, our joint program for students, what's wrong with this approach here? And if you deviate from it, maybe it's something that maybe some explaining is in order. Some of the features of this plain vanilla account that the Bureau thinks that the colleges and universities ought to arrange for their students would be, one, it's pretty much an online account. You don't have, it's a card-based account. It should be free. It's one that should provide online and mobile bank and bill pay free. It should provide no opportunity, and this is where free breaks down, no opportunity for any overdraft or insufficient funds access on these accounts. But if somehow or another an overdraft does occur, and they can occur in some cases even when the account doesn't explicitly provide for them, no fees would be allowed to be charged for that overdraft. And curiously, the account should also provide students two free money orders per month, or presumably then 24 a year. I was not aware that there's a strong demand on the part of college students to have money orders, but this plain vanilla account would require that as well. And there are a number of other provisions involved with it. The key question here is how, and the Bureau says this is optional, but how optional is this kind of a guide to universities when the Bureau makes it clear that all responsible institutions will use it? And remember, the Bureau has a means of making its advice a little more mandatory than you might think, in that the Bureau has authority to consider any kind of financial service that's provided at the retail level either unfair, deceptive, or abusive. We have some kind of case history as to what is meant by an unfair or deceptive practice, financial services practice. There is no case history yet for what counts as an abusive financial service or providing a financial service to on the retail level. But it's pretty clear that there aren't too many people that are lining up to attest what that abusive might be. So there are a number of concerns as to just how voluntary this is, and is it in effect promoting a plain vanilla account for college students all across the country. And by the way, if you're not a college student, then you don't need this help from the Bureau. It's only the college students that need the Bureau to help them out to figure out what's a good account or not. Let me pass now on to Todd to talk to us about mortgage lending and the impact of regulations.
Well, this is just reporting on a study that was done at the survey done by the Independent Community Bankers of America, talking about mortgage lending and the qualified mortgages rule, which, of course, we've been following over time and talking about the impact on consumer lending markets. According to this ICBA study survey, which seems to just be sort of produced as a press release, I haven't actually seen the underlying data of the survey, but what community bankers are reporting, 73% of community bankers said that regulatory burdens are preventing them from making more residential mortgage loans. They also say significant percentage of community banks have left the residential mortgage market or are considering an exit from it. 78% report that the number of staff members dedicated to lending compliance over the past 5 years have increased, and 44% said they originated fewer first lien residential mortgages in 2014 compared with the year before. And so basically what we are seeing here is that the regulatory fear and the cost of complying with regulations, most notably the qualified mortgages rule, is driving a lot of community bankers to decide that it's just simply not worth it to try to play in this market. And we'll have more on community banks later. But now I'll turn it back. Speaking of mortgages, I'm going to turn it over to Wayne to talk about the Bureau's new mortgage calculator.
Thanks again, Todd. On January 13th, the Bureau and its efforts constantly to be helpful to financial services customers began publishing on its website a mortgage interest rate calculator that it claims will help potential mortgage customers go out and rate shop and look for the best terms, the best rate for mortgages when they're looking to buy and finance a new house. Curiously, however, there are a number of things missing from this rate calculator, and there are a lot of objections raised by businesses that are in the mortgage business. The American Bankers Association, for example, with which I'm most familiar, submitted a letter to the Bureau encouraging the Bureau to withdraw its mortgage rate calculator because of the many inconsistencies and incompleteness of their tool. For example, the tool only looks at specific nominal interest rates. It excludes other of the transactional costs such as private mortgage insurance, government insurance, application and origination fees, flood insurance costs, appraisal costs, title insurance premiums, as well as any prepayment such as points and other things that are whereby you buy the rate down. The letter from ABA also pointed out that the tool doesn't really have a sufficient sample of rates in any of the geographic areas to give a full view of what the different rates are. And it's not clear what the quality assurance safeguards are to make sure that the data that the Bureau publishes is actually up to date and accurate. And moreover, there are other things that go into the price of a mortgage that are not considered, not looked in, as not presented to the customers who are looking at this rate indicator. They have no idea whether these are parts of the rate or not. Things such as how the price of a mortgage is governed by things like what kind of property is it? Is it a freestanding house? Is it a condominium? Is it a mobile home? Those all affect the potential rates. Is it a primary residence or an investment property? None of those are considered by the tool. The Bureau's tool also only looks at conventional mortgages and VA and FHA loans, not at other types of loans, which are a significant part of the market depending on which part of the country you're living in and what the rates are and the prices of homes are there. The tool, all these taken together, makes it pretty clear that if any mortgage company were to publish its rates without this kind of information being provided, the mortgage company would actually be in violation of the Bureau's own disclosure rules. And for those reasons, the request has been made that the Bureau withdraw its tool unless they can bring it up to appropriate standards that the Bureau itself has set. No word yet from the Bureau on what they plan to do. Back now to Todd to talk to us about, to Professor Zawicki to talk about a Harvard study on the effect of Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, just this week, February 9th, and an interesting paper was released by Professor, or I guess a senior fellow, Marshall Lux and Robert Green, entitled The State and Fate of Community Banking. And basically what the takeaway from the study is the rapid decline in the community banking sector in the United States. They note that in 1994, about 40% of the assets of American banks were held in community banks, and that's down to about 20% today. Now, it was probably inevitable that over time, America's highly fragmented banking system would probably start to consolidate. But what they note of particular interest is that in the period since Dodd-Frank was enacted, the decline in the share of assets of community banks, of all banks, has been twice as fast as it was in the period prior to Dodd-Frank. So that while they were falling about 6% in the years prior to Dodd-Frank, their percentage as a percentage of all banking assets has been twice as fast since Dodd-Frank, and they attribute this directly to Dodd-Frank, and in particular the regulatory cost associated with Dodd-Frank. And that, in that sense, it's consistent with the report we heard earlier about the ICBA study, and also prior research such as a great survey done last year by Hester Peirce and others at the Mercatus Center of small banks and the impact of Dodd-Frank on small banks in terms of the regulatory cost and the riskiness of lending under Dodd-Frank. The other thing that's particularly interesting about this study is it also goes into why this matters, which it isn't just a matter of what kind of banks we have, but it's also a matter of how much competition there is. And in particular, they note that a disproportionate amount of small business and agricultural lending is done by community banks, especially in rural areas. And so to the extent that we're getting this rapid elimination of community banks, that is could have an impact on the economy in terms of reducing the ability of small businesses and agricultural loans to be provided, and over the long time that could hurt American entrepreneurship and competitiveness. It's a very interesting study, a lot of interesting data, especially for people who are interested in those issues involving the future of rural banking and the particular market niche served by community banks. And then I'll give it back to Wayne for, I think, one last set of comments, and then we'll open the floor to callers after that.
Great. Thank you very much, Todd. And again, we're just trying to hit some of the highlights. There are many issues we haven't touched upon, and we'll be happy to touch upon those if you would like us to raise those during the Q&A, or if you have questions or comments on the issues we have raised. Last item I want to bring to our attention here of the ones we've chosen for today. On January 28th, the Bureau, in following up to significant responsibilities that the Dodd-Frank Act gives to the Bureau over financial literacy and financial education programs, released a report entitled Financial Well-Being, the Goal of Financial Education. The Bureau sees this report as something to help the Bureau as it looks at various types of financial education programs around the country, and will use this report and its findings to help them evaluate the quality of those financial education literacy programs. If you happen to have such a program, be aware that the Bureau may be looking at it to see just how good it is in the view of the folks here in Washington. The key element of this report is the Bureau's effort to surrounding the issue of a definition of financial well-being. The Bureau says that they believe that the ultimate measure of success of a financial education program is improvement in individual financial well-being. And that being the case, like any good bureaucracy, the Bureau feels it's important to define what financial well-being means for the whole nation. And that definition is focused on the following. They claim this is after nearly 60 hours of interviews for the nation of 330 million people. This 60 hours of interviews has given them enough information, they believe, to clearly define for all of us what financial well-being is. And here's their definition: having control over day-to-day and month-to-month finances, point one. Two, having the capacity to absorb a financial shock. Three, being on track to meet financial goals. And four, having the financial freedom to make the choices that allow you to enjoy life. Now, that's their definition, good or bad, who knows, but that's the one that they will use in evaluating the financial education programs that they look at. They do point out, however, that neither income nor net worth fully capture, in their view, financial well-being. And let me stop there. And again, as I say, we're very eager to respond to any questions or receive your comments on these or other related issues.
All right. Well, we'll open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, press star and then the pound key to ask a question. And one quick programming note while we're waiting for questions to jump on. We did have a shorter than usual announcement, but for those of you in the Washington, D.C. area, our D.C. Lawyers Chapter lunch is this Friday, February 13th, with Federal Society co-founder David McIntosh, who's now the head of the Club for Growth. Well, guys, we've got over 50 callers on the line, but they seem to be a little gun-shy of jumping in. Oh, looks like we did have our first question jump on.
Very good.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Hi, this is Warren Belmar. I thought you guys did a great job, Wayne, Todd.
Thank you very much.
Covering some of the issues. The first item that Wayne addressed on this absurd amount to redo an office building rather than building a newer, greater one for much less, perhaps outside of across the street from the White House, is just mind-boggling. Is there anything afoot in the Congress to stop this waste of money?
Todd, you want to jump on that? You led off with that issue.
Yeah, well, as I understand it, the catch is that this is just part of the CFPB slush fund, and that basically, because there's so little oversight of how the CFPB spends their money, my understanding is, and perhaps I'm wrong on the details of this, but my understanding is that that there's little control over the ability of the CFPB to spend this money. Perhaps there's some relationship with the GSA that I don't fully understand there. Wayne can straighten out. But Warren, you're exactly right. I mean, what Congressman Hensarling has observed is, in so many words, that is really valuable real estate. And if you just think about how much the federal government could get if they just sold that real estate and allowed that building to be knocked down and put up an office building and put the CFPB in a less ritzy neighborhood, one would think that this could turn out to be a boon to the federal budget. But what this really demonstrates is when you've got an agency who can just get $600 million a year, no questions asked, directly from the Federal Reserve, they have very little incentive to live like ordinary Americans or to take cost into account in the things that they do. For many people, it seems to exemplify the nature of the agency and its lack of any real ability to control what it's doing, even its administrative functions when it comes to this or comes to the constant complaints on personnel issues and those sorts of things tend to a lot of people evidence exactly what you'd expect from an agency that lacks proper oversight and control.
I do note, Todd, that when just a few years ago when the Securities and Exchange Commission needed a newer and larger facility, they at least tried to tie it into some kind of urban renewal effort in the parts of Northeast Washington, which is one of the poorer parts of the city, and put their office building there. Instead, the Bureau, they decided to occupy what has got to be very close to the most expensive spot in the city.
Well, my focus was more on what the Congress could do. Do riders on legislation that stop projects that are foolish. And in so many instances, part of the problems we're facing today are because Congress didn't do its job in writing tight legislative provisions. And if you delegate authority or create ambiguity, it is not surprising that the executive branch can interpret things and do things that are indeed within the parameters of poorly drafted legislation.
Yeah, but I think there's no doubt that part of the challenge
as a rider to just say we are going to preclude the spending of money to redo this building, period.
Yeah, it would take a change in the law. There's no doubt about that. The question is what piece of law they could do. I think what Chairman Hensarling is trying to do is win the argument, first expose the problem, so that there is enough outrage that such a change in the law could actually pass, and pass with the kind of supermajorities that are needed. Democrat votes would be needed to go along with Republican votes to have a supermajority, just to get it through the Senate, and then perhaps even to get it past a veto threat.
Well, I would, for one, urge that it be a single item, a single bill, outrageous circumstance, unbelievable amount of money to be spent to rehab a building that's going to be unusable for years. And it certainly would leave it for the Democrats to defend that kind of spending or for the president to veto a bill that restricts that kind of spending should it pass.
Yeah, very fair point.
So I don't know if Mr. Hensling's on the line or we'll hear of it, but My suggestion, Jeb, is do it.
Well, very good point, and certainly appreciate you raising that, Warren. Other comments, questions from other callers on the line?
Yes, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key, and our lines are open. Well, the good news for Mr. Hinserling, everyone else on the Hill, and all of our members is that this podcast, as well as all of our previous, all of our previous telephone calls, are posted as podcasts on our website at www.fedsoc.org. So at any time, you can go back and review these and download them to your smartphone and stream them or download them. So again, a star and then the pound key. We still have some time left.
While we're waiting, Todd, I would point out as we're looking at the Bureau, and the it seems to me that if, and I don't know that this is part of the strategy of the leadership in Congress, but if they were to do a budget that has reconciliation instructions, certainly that is a place where some sort of changes in either the Bureau's structure or how it manages its funds certainly could be something that is considered in that kind of a process. Mm-hmm. For those of you who aren't aware, reconciliation is a tool that's attached to budgets when Congress directs specific committees to pass legislation to carry out some of the budget savings, budget reduction, deficit reduction elements that are in the federal budget. And when those bills are reported by a committee, they move forward under expedited procedures, meaning that there's no filibuster allowed in the Senate, and the House has a specific period of time within which to consider those bills as well.
Looks like we did have one more question jump on the line.
Go ahead.
Hey, guys. This is Tony Cotto with the State Insurance Commissioners. Thank you again for another great update. It sounds like they've been quite busy, and I'm wondering if you have a sense of what they turn to next now that they've done the mortgage rules and sort of what's on the horizon. Are we going to see title insurers? Are we going to see, you said they've already sort of started on the payday lending track. What do you see coming down the pike next?
You want to step up first, Todd, on that?
I'm not sure what's coming up next because they mess around with the deadlines so much. It's hard to keep track of. They've got payday loans in the pipeline. They've got debt collection in the pipeline, and it's kind of hard to get a read on what some of this timing is. Do you have a sense, Wayne, of what might be ready to pop next?
Well, I was looking at a report today of a speech that Director Cordray gave to a meeting of credit unions here, I think might have been yesterday, and he mentioned payday lending is something that's very high on his agenda, as well as stored value cards, perhaps, looking at some of those. Some of the payment kind of vehicles that are in the retail space are things that he's looking at. He mentioned overdraft, but he indicated that isn't immediate for action. That still seems to be something they'll be turning to perhaps late summer. He said it's on the agenda, but things like payday lending, stored value cards seem to be ahead of that. The debt collection practices may be there as well.
They seem to pretty routinely push back deadlines on things, is my sense. And so, and they seem to do it repeatedly. So it's my sense, Wayne, that it's kind of hard to predict when some of these things are actually going to appear. Is that accurate?
I think that's certainly been the experience so far, and there's also a curious thing about the way the Bureau operates, which is somewhat unusual. It may be the part of the growing pains of a brand-new agency, or it may be this is the way they like to proceed. When they finalize a rule, they then frequently come back afterwards and make some additional changes and corrections to that rule even after it's been finalized, rather than making those changes based upon the comments that were made before they finalized the rule. So when a rule is put out as the final rule, if there are still problems and issues that need to be addressed, don't assume that there's no opportunity to raise those concerns and get some changes. So the reason why I raise that is in connection with a lot of the mortgage things. Even though they have completed most of the work on mortgage rules, they are still implementing those rules and have been, as recently as just a few weeks ago, making some additional tweaks to how those rules operate. For example, in the definition of what is a rural area in connection with their ability to pay rules, the qualified mortgage rule, they have expanded the population that is would be affected under rural area exemptions. From about 9% of the population to, according to their calculation, about 22% of the population.
All right. Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Okay, one more question just jumped on.
Great. Go ahead.
Hi, Todd and Wayne. This is Hester Peirce. I'm calling about a speech that's maybe not within the purview of what this call was supposed to be about, but last November, Cordray gave a speech to the clearinghouse, and he talked about improving the speed of the payment system. And I just was curious to get your reaction on whether you think that's an area that's within the CFPB's regulatory purview or whether he was maybe overstepping his jurisdiction there.
It looks to me, Hester, and I thought the same thing at the time, and I've seen in a couple of other examples. Director Cordray looks at both the jurisdiction of where they can take specific action, but then he looks at a larger penumbra, if you will, of where he can try to exercise the bully pulpit. And I think that's what he was doing in the area of payment system. I think his view is, well, these are retail payments, and people certainly would like to be able to think that payments are almost instantaneous when they use their credit card or debit card or otherwise try to move a payment. But it's pretty clear by the statute that authority for that was not passed on to the Bureau and resides with the Federal Reserve. Since the Federal Reserve has engaged in its faster payments initiative to try to get to pretty close or much closer to real-time payments. But I think that was an area where the Bureau was, or the director of the Bureau was trying to use, as I say, its bully pulpit to try to influence things.
Of course, the mere fact that the CFPB isn't authorized to regulate an industry rarely seems to be an obstacle if they decide that they want to. They have with the auto dealers, and I think related to this particular point, Wayne, was the issue that you and Jerry discussed on the January call about the Sprint case.
Yes, good example.
Involving essentially using the payment processing of by the phone company there as basically being a vehicle for the CFPB to assert jurisdiction over, I believe it was the sale of particular apps or ringtones or something. If they start sniffing around, they seem to be pretty entrepreneurial about figuring out ways to try to attach themselves to things that seem to be under the jurisdiction of other agencies.
And that would be pretty normal practice for any kind of agency, a bureaucracy. They do try to build empires. When you have an agency that has so little oversight, then perhaps it happens more frequently and with a greater extent.
There was actually a piece in the American Banker on January 13th. It's interesting that you use the building an empire language by Eric Grover, who is a payment consulting firm, who specifically addressed this this issue that Hester was and the speech that Hester was referring to in terms of this instruction to the clearinghouse, and he pointed out and used exactly that that particular language, building an empire, as the CFPB tries to bring more and more under its ambit.
Mm. Well, it's nice to see that others are observing these phenomena as well. Any other questions, comments from the callers?
Yeah, so again, star on the pound key if you'd like to ask a question of our experts. Well, Wayne and Todd, I think it looks like we've exhausted the questions.
Well, appreciate that. Appreciate everybody's participation and your continued interest in the activities of the Bureau. They're not going away.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank once again Todd Zawicki and Wayne Abernathy for being with us and doing this call. Thanks to our audience for calling in and for your questions. And a reminder to stay tuned for the announcement for next month's update. And just again, a reminder that you can find the recording of this teleforum call as well as all of our previous calls on our website at fedsoc.org. So until next time, we're adjourned. Have a great afternoon, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.